It's Wednesday, December 9th, 2009, and you're listening to episode 172 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 51 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
This is Wayne. And you know what? I miss Chris. Pat, do you miss Chris?
I do miss Chris. Dan, I wish you were Chris? Here.
I miss Chris, too.
Chris!
Hey!
Yay!
Woo! I don't miss Chris.
You know why I don't miss Chris? It's a quality issue. It's like he just phones in every episode.
Yeah. No kidding.
Actually, wait a minute. I forgot. I don't miss Chris either, because when he's not here, I actually talk.
Yeah, so shut up.
See you next time, guys.
All right, Pat. It was nice talking to you.
Insightful as always, Pat.
All right, Wayne, you have a surprise banter topic for us. I have no idea where this is headed.
Surprise.
So what is your surprise banter topic?
Well, Chad may be a bit of a non-Christmas person. He seems to be a bit of a bah humbug.
I am.
I, however, am trying to get in the Christmas mood. So, Dan, I have an early Christmas gift for you.
Oh, my gosh. What is this?
And while you're opening this, I will have a picture of this up on the forums for everyone that's listening, so you'll be able to see just what I got him.
What he got me, I don't even know where you found this.
Your pride?
It's a coin bank.
Yep, it is.
Oh, cool.
It's about maybe, I guess, 8 inches tall or so, and it's a model of Slimer.
A very detailed model
from
of
Ghostbusters.
Slimer.
Is this a recent thing, or is this like...
It is. My comic book shop actually ordered two of them by mistake, and I walked in and saw it sitting on the shelf, and immediately thought, Dan has to have this.
Well, thank you, Wayne.
Cool.
Wow. That
is, I can't get over how detailed this is. I mean, this isn't just like some little plastic piggy bank that, I guess it is plastic.
It is.
I mean, it's not like a cheap dollar store.
It's plastic. Yeah, it's a hard, it's good hard plastic.
Plastic or maybe resin. But yeah, the detail of the carving, the detail of the painting, for a little tchotchke or whatever, it's a pretty impressive level of detail. You know, I have not had a Ghostbusters anything in my possession for a long time. Because like a lot of kids growing up, there came this point where I had a large collection of toys, and I guess it wasn't really even that large. I mean, I had a noteworthy amount of toys, and eventually mom decides, well, there's too much junk in the house. It's time for all this to go. And of course, parents do not understand your nostalgia, the fact that even some of this may have been worth something later on. And so out all of it goes, you're... Action Comics number one.
Yeah.
I was actually
wondering how many of those ended up in a landfill.
That never happened to me. All of my old toys are still in boxes and storage in my parents' basement.
Most of mine are, but the biggest mistake my mom ever made, and she actually knew it when she did it. Every year we'd have a scout like garage sale when I was in the Boy Scouts. And one year she went through stuff and she went through my old toys and she got my whole collection of Matchbox and Hot Wheels cars, and she put them in this garage
sale.
I bet
she got a whole nickel for it.
Well, and she knew that she'd made a mistake when one guy took the whole box of them up and said, "What do you want for this?"
Yeah,
and then he took them all. At the time, I was like 10, 12, whatever. I'm like, yeah, I don't play with anymore. I don't care. It was like right before I had gotten to the point where I realized collectible value. And so, yeah, I don't even give her grief about it. She gives herself grief about it because, like I said, she recognized her mistake.
I don't have any toys from my childhood.
I have
some. I don't have a single one because my parents and I think about every year, we would collect all of the reigned, not every single toy I own, but all the old toys and give them to the Salvation Army. And then the next year we'd get all the old toys and give them to the Salvation Army until I got to a point to where I stopped getting toys and I kept giving them to the Salvation Army. And I don't think I even my old classic Nintendo I gave to Dan's sisters.
Yes, they still have it.
Yeah.
And I think they still use it. And the only reason they may use it less is because of the Wii, because the Wii has so many of those titles on download now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
I don't even remember how that came about. I don't remember. Did they like ask me for it?
I have no idea.
Because I never really interacted with your sisters very much.
I don't know if you gave it to me and then I don't remember. But it even still has the turbo thing on it.
I had that too, the NES or
the NES,
whatever it was called.
I had a family member who worked at the Chrysler plant down here, and she gave me one. You know how cars have on the side of them turbo electronic fuel injection stuck on the side? It's like, it's not a sticker per se, it's a 3D piece of plastic.
An emblem or whatever they call it.
Yeah, it's like an emblem. She gave me one of those, and I peeled the backing off it, and it fit perfectly on that little hinge lid on my Nintendo. So I had a turbo, electronically fuel-injected classic Nintendo.
Awesome. Nice. The only toys I know for sure I still have is my parents kept all my Transformers. Mm. So I still have all those.
Which we are grateful for.
I've been talking to a couple different people who think that this whole thing is swinging the other direction. Because unlike previous generations, there is now such an awareness that something might be collectible someday that people tend to hang on to everything, which is having the reverse effect.
And the moment someone realizes that it could be collectible, that's when it's no longer collectible.
Well, and that's having the reverse effect now where the market for comic books, baseball cards, all that is crashed. Where some of that's economy, some of that's interest levels. They're not as popular as
they used to be. There was a market because they were never meant to be collectibles. Mm-hmm. People bought them, they got destroyed, and suddenly they became rare. The moment people realize they're collectibles, they make more of them, they sell more of them, and everyone has one, so you don't need that.
When everyone's special, no one is.
Yeah, and to me, that's one of the problems with it. We're talking about toys. Toys are meant to be played with.
Yeah.
And that's the problem is that people, and even kids, buy these toys, and they don't take them out of the box, and they display them, and they're glad to have them and stuff. No, take that crap out of the box, rip the box up, play with it till it breaks, and then give the pieces to poor kids.
I was an odd child with my toys because I collected Transformers and G.I. Joe. That's just
the you can't give broken toys to poor kids anymore.
Well, yeah. True. But I took all of my toys. I took like my Transformers. I took them all out of the boxes and then I cut the boxes up and kept the parts that made sense because they had the stats and everything on the back and the Transformer points that could send in for stuff. But then I would play with the toys. And this is partly goes back a couple of episodes where I said, you know, I grew up basically alone, an only child out in the in the country with no other kids to play with. So I played with my toys.
That's the same way, only in the suburbs.
Yeah, I played with my toys by myself, but I'd transform them, and I'd transform them back, and then I would sit them on their shelf. That's what I did. I didn't, like, crash them or destroy them. I'd take them, like, down maybe one or two at a time, transform around, and then
I totally broke my friend's, his name's Kaplan. Yeah. Dan knows him. I totally broke his Megatron. Uh-huh. I transformed it into the pistol.
Yeah.
And when I put the last piece in place, I don't remember what I did. I squeezed it too hard. I pulled it or I tried to undo it. And something cracked and broke, and it was stuck in the pistol forever.
Whoops. Mm.
Yeah.
See, all of my old toys were whittled from wood on the back 40. So.
From the mother tree.
That's right.
Chris, the first fruit of Gaia.
You ain't kidding.
No, I still have most of my Star Wars figures, you know, because that was what was hot when I was younger. The original go-around, you know, the 77 through 83.
I had a Millennium Falcon.
Yeah, the figure-sized one or the die-cast one?
No, I had the playset Millennium Falcon.
Yes, I had that.
The
yep.
Jabba the Hutt playset. I had a Rancor. I had two Scout
ATSTs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had two of those, and I had the Snow Fighters they used in the second movie.
The Speeders.
Yeah.
Snow
Speeders, that's it. Probably even for the 80s, hundreds and hundreds of dollars worth of Star Wars toys. Gave it all away.
Wow.
I don't regret it one single bit. Because, I'm just not a nostalgic person, and somebody else got to play with it.
You know, when it comes to the Star Wars stuff, I got a lot of the playsets, too. I had the original Death Star playset. I had one for the Darth Vader Super Star Destroyer. Had that one as well. But the Death Star was actually pretty cool because it had the trash compactor thing in there with little foam garbage and the little monster. And you had actually a screw wall that you could twist this little crank and it would, you know, compress the wall. The wall would cave in and squish your figures in there with this foam garbage, which was pretty impressive.
You know, speaking of foam, I never had any of the playsets. What I used to do is my playset would be anything that we had just gotten, the foam that came in the box. Because you could punch it out and punch your way through walls and things. And when I would be, I had mostly G.I. Joes and stuff. But I would get into these elaborate, long stories where time travel would become involved, and before long, the characters had traveled back and interacted with themselves 5-6 times, and it would become so convoluted that I'd be sitting there playing at one point, and I'd just stop and be like, okay, this is ridiculous, I'm done.
Speaking of your Matchbox, Pat, I want to go back, because I have a philosophical question to ask about this, because I had Hot Wheels. I was a Hot Wheels snob, I never did Matchbox, but when you played with the cars, and this kind of really goes for everybody, but when you played either Matchbox or Hot Wheels, were you someone who, when you simulated the motion of the cars in a high-speed chase, would you push the cars along the floor or whatever surface you're playing on, or would you hold them still and then just imagine them going at that high speed?
I have something completely completely different, Chris, from what I did. I actually had one that was a DeLorean that I put on a like a model train set, and I would bring the train right up to the edge of it, and then I'd hit it at full speed, pushing the DeLorean along the train set.
A very Back to the Future 3 of you.
Yeah, no kidding.
That's true. Exactly.
No, that explains your time travel fantasies.
That's right. Now, actually, I would run them along whatever surface, you know, so I would actually
like
move
cow
them.
Cow patty.
Yeah,
I would move them too.
I wouldn't just hold
the cow patty garage.
Do I take that to mean that you would just sort of hold them there steady and you would imagine like the carpet going really fast underneath them? Or
yeah, I always held mine still and then just visualize it speeding along my mind. And granted, if it would be turning corners or stuff, yeah, then I would turn the car and twist it here and there or crashes. But
you know the difference, Pat. We had like sports cars and stuff.
He had a Model
His
T.
Hot Wheels were Model Ts. So
I don't even think that. I think they were horse and buggy.
If they got moving too quick, someone might get hurt in the rumble seat.
That's awesome. But see, I also...
It really was just people running.
Like But I also had... I remember I had the figure eight track that had the thing that... It was a little foam thing that you twist it up and it would get spinning really fast. Then you push the car through and it would jettison it out and you know, around the figure eight track. So
I always wanted one of those.
It was cool. Yeah. You know what? I had an aunt. She didn't have kids and she's always made good money and she's always been exceedingly generous with all of us cousins and our children now. So like most of my Star Wars toys, we're talking the Millennium Falcon, the X-Wing, the B-Wing, all this kind of stuff she bought for me for Christmas. I got a lot of good stuff from my aunt.
Nice.
Yep.
My parents just beat me and were buying my silence.
Hey,
I got a lot of cool stuff.
Some people get beaten and don't get toys for it.
Exactly.
Chris, you wanted to talk about the upcoming release of The Road, which apparently is going to be a limited release.
Well, here's the deal. First of all, your intro right there, your segue right there, goes to show the mistake that was made. Because the movie's already out. And for those of you who don't know, The Road is a Cormac McCarthy book. It was an Oprah Book Club book. Don't let that change your opinion of it by any stretch of the imagination.
I never do. I've read some really great Oprah books.
It's a very good book. It's definitely worth the read. But they had made it into a movie. The movie actually was supposed to be released last year, but they held it because they felt that Viggo Mortensen, Aragorn, for those of you Lord of the Rings nerds, that he had a good Oscar shot. So they made it, basically all the fans, all the people who wanted to see this movie, who had read the book, made them wait a year, and they were going to release it the end of November. Well, that comes around, and what happens is, as quite a surprise to everyone, the movie went out in limited release. Rather than go to 2,000-plus screens cross-country, it went to 31 screens in like small art house theaters in certain areas. And with no real announcement that this was happening, I kind of went on their Facebook page and kind of checked this out, and I found out that I wasn't the only one who was obviously very irate about this. There's people all over the country who were kind of complaining about this. And eventually it got to the point where, yeah, they said, okay, we're going to release it a little bit more. And what happened was, too, on its release day, it got the highest per-screen average for all the films released that week. It made some ungodly amount, like $6,000 per screen that it's on. And when you consider 31 screens, that's quite a bit of attendance there. So that should have given an indicator that this film should be in a wide release. My problem was when I noticed that these people who were complaining about it obviously were not in the markets where this movie was, is that in the age of social media, where you have Facebook, you have Twitter, you have blogs, you have all this other interconnectivity with the internet, it is ridiculous to do that type of release anymore in the hopes of getting big buzz from large cities and making some money there. When it seems to me that a wider release, a standard wide release, even if the movie is not necessarily that popular, is going to help the movie in the long run, because you're going to get people who see it, blog about it, post on their Facebook about it, Twitter about it, whatever they do to try and make people go see this movie, which clearly in a situation like this, there's a lot of devotees who want to see this movie. I don't understand the money-making logic behind this. I understand if they did it just purely for, so to qualify for Oscar. I get that. But at the same time, if you're doing it trying to make money, which really is kind of the ultimate goal for the majority of movies, especially big studio ones like this, it doesn't make any sense to me anymore.
Truth be told, I don't think this is something that you're going to have to worry about for a whole lot longer anyway.
I hope not.
There is one thing that the internet has forever changed, and I think this is a change that has begun but is not yet finished, which is for the entire lifespan of modern media up until the internet, people with a lot of money and a lot of power sitting in corporate offices have controlled one thing, which is distribution. You can make a movie, but if you want that movie out there, you better know the right people, kiss the right ass, or have dump trucks full of money to cover the process. But what the internet has done is it has created a platform by which anyone with a minimal amount of investment and such can distribute anything. I fear the boot right now is being heard literally all across the globe because of the fact that the internet allows us to distribute something that probably no corporate suit would have ever greenlit to begin with. And I have a prediction, and a lot of people get kind of riled up when I say this, but I think it is absolutely true, and I think it is inevitable, that within our lifetime, well, okay, not Chris's, but within everybody else's lifetime, I think we will see near death of the movie theater. Because right now...
Do you
now,
really think that will happen? Because they've said that for ages with TV and with, you know, with everything else. And do you think that this is the time?
Yes. And here's why. And I'm not saying tomorrow, okay? I'm not saying this is going to happen tomorrow. But I think this will happen within the next couple decades. People talk about all the time, well, I love the experience of just going to the theater, having the big screen, having my popcorn, blah, blah, blah. And I realize that. I understand that. But I think the majority of people in the majority of situations, if they had access to a new release and you could watch it at home with your friends without waiting in line and you've got a good home theater, I think people are going to go that direction. I think there are some hurdles that have to be jumped to get here. The first thing is you need a little bit more penetration.
Yeah, you do.
Broadband internet. And also people have really good home theaters. I also think there is going to
both.
It's going to take someone to do this with a major title. But imagine if Batman 3, when it comes out in 2011 or whatever, if it, in addition to theaters, they put this as a $50 or $100 pay-per-view event on your cable service.
No, I would not.
I would. I absolutely would.
I don't know if I would engage someone like that because it could work for certain things. I think
not for
in your equation, the price point would have to be the same as what I'd have paid to go to a theater.
Well, but the reason I say 50 to 100 is because remember, it's, let's say, a big screen TV. How many people can you sit in front of that?
Yeah, I get your point there.
That's true.
And I think I agree with you on your point, Dan, but it saddens me because just of the way things have gone in the last, say, 3 to 5 years, there's been such an emphasis on taking things down to the smallest freaking screen you can get. Honestly, I don't understand the people that watch anything on their iPods because they're watching it on a 3-inch wide screen. I don't like that. I don't even want to watch a television show on that because
you and David Lynch.
Well, you miss details.
You should.
I love the big screen. I love to go to the biggest screen in St. Louis to see certain movies. Your Star Trek, Star Wars, any of the big movies like that, because it's just awesome.
There's a David Lynch interview where he just starts. How could people watch a movie on a iPhone?
You have not watched a movie on an iPhone.
You've not watched a movie. He doesn't.
You haven't experienced it. You haven't heard a movie. You think you watch a movie. It's sad that you think you've watched a movie on your phone.
And then he just degrades into cussing.
Yeah.
And never actually provides any reason.
It was hard to even do an interpretation right here without the cussing because that's so key.
Well, yeah. And you know what?
It's a great interview.
And I disagree because I've watched Spider-Man 2 came with my PSP and I've watched that a couple of times on my PSP. And I enjoy it. I put some headphones on and I get into the movie. On the other hand, I have a 59-inch television at home. I mean, I got this big, gigantic, huge flat-screen television at home, and I enjoy movies on that. And then 5 minutes away, I have a theater that has one of those huge, giant mega screens, and I enjoy movies on that. Just enjoy movies.
What I can see happening, though, and this kind of goes along with Pat's point, and it splits the road just a little bit, is that I can see Dan's scenario, but at the same time existing with that, I can see a rise in popularity with the IMAX format. And then the standard current movie screen size that we see right now slowly start to fade away. Because I went and saw Episode 2 and I think Matrix Revolutions when they had them available for IMAX. You know, just opinions of the film notwithstanding, those are huge spectacle movies on a 6-story screen. And they're unbelievable to see the large scope of what both of those movies provide. You know, whether it's the fight scenes or the space battle scenes, unbelievable on a screen that size. And I think the appeal of that, I don't think that will go away anytime soon because it's so huge and it fits in that American mentality.
here's the thing. I'm not saying theaters will disappear within our lifetime.
They thought that back in the 60s.
Right. What I am saying
and
is
they almost did.
I think that what we will see within our lifetime is that the sit-down big screen movie theater will go the same way as the drive-in theater. There will still be some out there, but they're not going to be...
It'll be more of a nostalgia thing.
Yes. Every time I talk to somebody about this, I said, wait a minute. Let's imagine a future where you have a really nice high-definition TV. You have a really good surround sound system because that's what's in every home at this imaginary future. Just like VCR players were once a luxury item and now we don't even want them anymore. You know, this technology is moving forward. And I can put you on release night for a brand new movie for a price that's going to be about the same as buying the movie tickets for the number of people that would sit in front of your TV anyway. Whatever that may be. I just made up $50 to $100. But whatever that is, I really think people are going to go for that. And everyone I've talked to who has lashed out at me that you're full of crap, that's never going to happen.
You have a red handprint on your face right now.
I do.
Because you told somebody earlier today.
Always... either an emotional or nostalgic appeal. It's never a logical market appeal. It's always, well, I have so many fond memories, blah, blah, blah. That will never happen. It's like, guys, come on. The same way that your parents had so much fun at the ballpark, something like ESPN season ticket will never catch on.
You know, I don't 100% agree with you, Dan, mainly because I don't agree with your timetable. And I don't.
Well, I said within our lifetime.
Yeah. I know.
I'm 33. That's
I know that 30 years. Yeah,
that's 50, 60 years.
I'm not going to stand here and predict the death of the movie theater. Not even in my lifetime yet. I'm not going to be pro or anti movie theater right now. I just know what I like and what I experience because I am a huge movie buff. I love movies.
And you're missing a demographic here too, Dan. The big thing is, as long as teenagers and single people need legitimate entertainment to take dates to, movie theaters will always have a strong audience.
Yeah, but wait a second, though. I'm going to defend Dan here in this one because, you know, okay, quote unquote, dinner and a movie. Well, hell, if I was in the dating scene, why not even make a better impression? Invite somebody over, make them dinner, and then sit down and watch a movie on demand. You know,
doesn't work for teenagers living in their parents' house.
Well, but you know what? Absolutely it does. Now, I say this because, honestly, if my oldest was going to say, yeah, a bunch of the guys are going to come over and we're going to watch movies, I'd be like, absolutely, come on over. Because, and this comes from clearly from a parental aspect, you know where they are, and you know what they're doing.
That's exactly why don't want to do that.
If you have the sweet-ass home theater system to make that happen, then they want to be there.
Okay, hold on a second. We've gone way off down a rabbit trail because what I'm going to argue is that
I'm just mad at the Weinsteins because they're screwing me over, and I can't stand those f***ers for taking away my movie, damn it. Well, I made a whole
Chris,
year for this movie,
hold
and
on,
it's
Chris,
pissing me off. I
hold
want
on,
to see
I have one thing to say to you on that topic, Chris. That movie is showing in 1 hour downtown at the Tivoli here in St. Louis,
and we can
go watch it if we want. So your problem is not my problem.
You know, I wonder if part of that is they just don't think there's a market for it.
Well,
if they don't think it's that popular, maybe they don't want to release it everywhere.
All it is, really, I think for them, it's ego stroking and penis waving because they want the Oscars.
It's got to be a monetary reason.
Yeah, no, I agree with Chad. It's got to be monetary. Don't think there's enough market to justify the money.
But I don't buy that because this book was so popular. This book was huge. This book was a huge seller book. How could you not think it's popular? And Cormac McCarthy, and all they got to do is say from the author of No Country for Old Men, blah, blah, blah.
Quick note on that is that, I don't know, I mean, maybe scarcity creates demand, creates the market later on.
That's why everyone's asking for Chris.
I mean, there's countless
things. I've missed these arguments, Chris.
Look at Family Guy, which in its original run did really only kind of mediocre on TV, but went gangbusters on Adult Swim and DVD sales.
Futurama.
Yeah.
Jericho is another example.
Jericho.
But getting back to the original point is, yes, you can name... I am not predicting the death of the movie theater because I think there will always be a demographic that wants to get away, that doesn't have the big screen, wants to see something in OmniMax, 3D Vision, whatever it is. What I am saying is I think once people start making these things available on demand to the households that are capable of playing them or willing to play them, that demographic of moviegoers will shrink such that you'll have less movie theaters. Just like comic books went from you had a comic shop on every street corner, or before that, you had comic books in every 7-Eleven and whatever, to now, there's very few comic shops, even in major cities, and even a lot of those are having to either close down or diversify to stay afloat. Because there are fewer readers. And I think in the same way, there will never be fewer movie watchers, but I think there will be fewer theater goers. And every argument of nostalgia and emotion just does not float with me, because those same arguments were raised at every prior change of media, and it didn't stop the march of progress.
Yeah, for me, it's not a nostalgia thing at all. I think the date market will keep them alive.
If you look at the history of it, though, people have been predicting the death of movie theaters for years and years, ever since the advent of the television, the popularization of the television into the American home. People have been predicting the death of movie theater for years.
But how the movie theaters have survived is by change. Once it goes back to distribution, they change what they're distributing.
Well, they serve beer.
most of them don't. That's just around here. But it used to be you went to the theater, you got a cartoon, a comedic skit,
the news.
Maybe a feature, and you went home. Well, then TV
started
offering
that. You remember those days, right, Chris?
I remember going and seeing the Newsies. Yeah, the weekend Nickelodeons. Oh, absolutely.
But then the TV started offering that, so movies changed to offering feature films. But once again, you break down that distribution monopoly. If you give me the option of going out to my TV and pulling down Batman 3 via Charter on demand, I'm telling you right now, I would not
pay $50 to $100 for it. Well, I just would.
But people pay the price point.
I think the price point is valid, though.
I would never enter a
theater. People will pay the same amount for a boxing event, a sporting event, a concert. People do pay those kind of amounts, and they do exactly what Dan's saying. They call up all their buddies, they get everyone over to watch.
Everybody pitches in $10.
I don't think that price point is completely outrageous, but it would keep the casual person, I'm going to watch this by myself, probably not going to happen as much with a $50.
All right,
you know what? Can I just add one tangent to this? One thing I'm noticing, speaking of the advance of technology, we had mentioned VHS before, and this holiday season we have reached that quote unquote tipping point in regards to DVD and Blu-ray with two recent movie releases, Terminator Salvation and Harry Potter, which came out today. The Blu-ray price is less and is also the only thing that contains all the special features. If you got the DVD version of Terminator Salvation, you got the movie, that's it. Everything else cool that you would want, the alternate endings never before seen, the extra footage, blah-de-blah, Mick G stroking himself on camera, all of those things.
And eventually they might do it to a good movie.
That comes on the Blu-ray. And the same thing, maybe, but don't stop, push it. And then the same thing with Harry Potter, I noticed today. Blu-ray version comes with all the special features, new footage from the new movie, and it also, interestingly enough, comes with a copy of the for DVD. Guy who was with me bought the Blu-ray copy, even though he doesn't have a Blu-ray player, just so he could eventually get access to the special features.
You know why they're starting to do that, though, Chris? Blu-ray isn't reaching the market penetration they thought it would. Yes, it is selling more, but there's not as big of a... I've had this argument with a ton of people, and I think you may even agree with me here. But Blu-ray, there's not as big of a jump from DVD to Blu-ray. A good upscaling DVD player quality with what most people have in their houses for TVs and sound.
I think that there's really only one way to settle this argument, and I think that that's for the entire Fear the Boot cast, save Chris, to go tomorrow and see The Road.
And then the next episode we review it.
That's going to be the banter topic for next week.
Tomorrow night, Fear the Boot, we'll go see The Road.
Minus Chris, of course.
Yeah, at the theater that has not Moolah. Never mind. Yeah.
Tivoli. Moolah Shrine would be wonderful.
Chris, I will keep you in mind as I'm sitting next to these guys. I will fart on them.
Chris, thank you. I hate you guys.
I will Twitter.
I will tweet the out of this movie.
All right, so let's pretend we're an RPG podcast. Chris, during Fear the Boot's golden age, by which I mean your recent absence.
Yes. Yeah, you guys clearly have shot through the roof in popularity since I've left. It has not gone unnoticed.
We talked about advice for a new GM. We talked about Wayne trying to get into running a new game for the first time. But you apparently had your own experience over Thanksgiving trying to get a new GM started that apparently did not go so well. And I would love to hear a report on this.
You know, it's true.
No, I don't know, which is why I asked.
No, it is true. It was not a good experience. You know, I've been running my son and some of his friends occasionally. We were playing 3.5 for a while, and then we were going to switch over to Savage World as far as the system went for various reasons. But I've been teaching these guys who are all basically noobs to the game, kind of this the way role-playing works and just kind of running things. Well, one of the guys, he got in touch with some of his other friends outside of this group, and they wanted to play D&D, and he had decided to step up and become DM. He wanted to talk to me about books and about prices and, you know, what to choose and that kind of thing. And it kind of came down to where I knew he was an unemployed teenager. Odds were he wasn't going to be able to spring for any books, and he sounded like his group wanted to do 3-5. So I'm like, well, here, why don't you just take my books? So on Thanksgiving, we ended up going over to his house because we're very good friends with his parents. And I brought him my player's guide, my DMG, and the monster manual. And I'm like, here you go. And as he started to look through there and we started to just kind of talk a little bit, I realized very quickly, and this was like right after I set the books down, that I just handed this guy like over 1,000 pages, and all he really knows how to do is kind of has access to the rules, because when we started, he didn't do character creation. I gave them pre-gens, so he had never even created a character. He'd done backstories and stuff, and he was very good at that, but he never really created a character. And so he like started to ask a couple questions, and I realized that me trying to coach him from the very beginning and how to DM, this was not going to work. How do you take a 300-page book, just the player's book, and start describing to him, what are you going to do? You know, here's some character types, here's some things. Because in this particular game, and this is really more kind of a comment on 3.5, I guess, or just crunchy rule systems in general, there's a lot to digest. Kind of see on his face that he just seemed really overwhelmed. And I didn't have the time, because of the circumstances, it being, you know, a holiday and you're doing these kinds of things, I didn't really have the time to properly sit down with him and kind of go through and really give him some guidance. I mean, I kind of gave him some general directions on what to do when it comes to being a DM, but nothing in clear way of advice. And I kind of, thinking about it afterwards, I felt really bad about it, because it's like almost gave him the books and then threw him outside.
You know, Chris, I envision you walking up to this kid, dropping like 50 pounds of books in his arm. He's barely holding it up, and you're like, go on. Good game.
Yeah.
Keep going.
It's like a freshman on their first day of college, you know, and they have all of these stuff they have to try and digest for the term paper due tomorrow.
What? You don't understand it? You need more books? I got more books. Here's more books. Take more books.
But, you know, it was like, it was difficult to find a really solid starting point with where do we even approach this from?
Well, Chris, let's translate that into some kind of advice. If you were to go back in time and do this all over again, how would you have done it differently?
You know, I think if I went back,
picked a different system?
Well, that would have been one. I would have said, look, you know, you're brand new with this. You should find something real easy to do. If I had to go back with a crunchy rules system, I guess I would say to him, sit down, and you're all as a group going to have to just go through the process bit by bit and all create characters together, you know, and really like what we've talked about before, build that group template if necessary, you know, and find some sort of starting point. Once you've got that, then you don't really have to necessarily worry about them anymore. But from that point, you as a DM, now you've got to go and try and figure out where to start and how to start, you know, and then I would go into advice, you know, steal. Look at movies, look at TV shows, look at books, and steal their plots. And you know, take out that hard part of the equation.
Steal the plots, not the book. Just to be clear, we don't advocate stealing books.
Yeah, don't go stealing somebody's movies and TV shows and books and DVDs and things. No, go and steal their plots. Because that's really kind of the hardest part, is coming up with, what am I going to do with these guys? What are they supposed to do? Steal somebody else's plot, and then just build off of that and really devote your time to learning the rules.
Well, Chris, for somebody that's brand new to this, especially a younger kid, why not maybe say throw them a module to run? I mean, yeah, there can, but it's all in there. You know, you can read through it. It's got everything that you're going to need to do. It's all laid out for you. I think it's a good way for you to learn the ropes, to get an idea of the kind of things you got to put together as a GM.
And I did recommend that.
And do that a couple times and then branch it on your own. But at least you can see, oh, wow, okay, this is the kind of prep work I need to do for a story.
I actually kind of disagree with that.
I completely agree with it.
I do agree with that. I think that that's not a bad approach to take. And I did recommend it to him. I'm saying, look, you know, there's a lot of resources online where you could probably find some good starter adventures. I even think I might have some. But, you know, go in, I don't know.
Well, hold on, Chad, why do you disagree with that?
Well, because I think that when we're talking about D&D, I think the vast majority, and there are exceptions to this rule,
right?
But the vast majority of modules out there are not conducive to role-playing. They are hack and slash adventures, Monty Hall, where you just read a little bit of box text, and it's a dungeon. It's a dungeon crawl, and here are the monsters. And yes, you will learn the mechanics of it. You will learn
what you're really
of,
going for here, though?
No, well, I don't think so. I don't think
it's
no,
easier to roleplay.
Well, I disagree.
Wait. Do you want me to say it or not?
Go. Yes, go please. Finish.
Okay.
Oh, I want you to say it.
I bet you do. So what you are trying to do for a new GM and a new player is not necessarily teach them the rules. The rules will come. The rules are in a book. They can read it on their own time. I mean, you do want to help. You don't want to do the opposite extreme of what Chris did. Here's the encyclopedia set. I need A through G by Monday. But what you want to do is you want to get them started in good habits of role-playing, getting your players to role-play, thinking on their feet, using those GM tools that we took a long time to learn, that everybody takes a long time to learn. You know, where you have an idea for something, you have a scene played out in your mind that you want them to do, but the players go off somewhere else where you don't plan on it, and then you can move that around. You're locked down in a module. There's no role-play. I mean,
I'm going to agree with Chad. Here's why. Wayne, and I don't want to beat this to death too much because we talked about this for an episode, but when you went to run Mutants and Masterminds, you got so hung up on the rules and so hung up on the core systems that you forgot the basics of running a good game.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And
modules don't teach basics.
Modules don't teach basics. And on top of that, well, D&D, because it's generic fantasy, is arguably, depending on the person, a good game for maybe introducing a new role player to the concept. I think it is a really bad thing to set a first-time GM loose on because, as we noted, it is an overwhelming rules canon. It would be far easier to give someone Savage Worlds Explorers Edition or some other really simple, generic, flexible system. So the rules not going to be an intimidating factor.
Right. You can focus on... You don't want them to get in the way.
And I don't want to go the opposite extreme. I mean, everyone knows I'm anti-combat and all that sort of stuff, but for a new GM, I would not recommend one of these, as they're called, story stick games. I think that the game should have a bit of crunch to it. They should learn that. They should use experience and advancement and that sort of thing. There should be structure to it so that the GM can learn all these different concepts and then take and give as he wills as he gets more experience. To me, a module locks you down. I mean, what's the most important thing to a GM is... first thing out of the box, creating a story. Well, what do you do when you hand them a module? You're handing them the story. They don't create the story. Then creating the NPCs and giving the NPCs character and balancing the NPCs. They're not creating NPCs. They're not giving them life. They're not giving them background. It's provided for you. Even if the module is heavy into role-playing and stuff, all the role-playing is predefined for you. You just have to act out the part that you're given. And the GM almost turns into another player. He turns into this functionary for the player. I'm not bashing modules. I think modules are fine for what they are. But no, a starting GM needs to learn all of these different basics, like how to come up with a campaign. The math, the rules, it's just math. It's easy. Even if the rules are a bit crunchy, a person can figure it out. It's just basic algebra.
Well, when you say a module, what do you have in mind for a module? Like, how long are we talking? Because when I think module, I think one or two shot. Basically, like, if you're starting a new system, occasionally we've had the let's run a quick combat to see how that's going to work.
You've never...
so we understand.
You've never played through a module before.
No, I haven't.
So
technically, the Wayne, you have.
Was that a module you were running, Chris?
It was a module in the sense that, yes, it was something that I wrote, but everything was all kind of pre-programmed in regards to what was there. The character that you played when you were doing this at Fear the Con, that wasn't your character. It was the piece of paper that was handed to you that you imprinted something on, but it wasn't necessarily you.
You probably hear papers and stuff in the background here. What we're doing is we're handing Wayne piles of modules that we have. And I want to... one of the things I'm noticing is that... you know, Wayne, you asked that question, how long's a module? How long is it? What's the concept?
Because what I see in mind is if a module is like a one-shot or a two-weekend thing, do that to get everyone comfortable before they create characters for a campaign. I hate the idea of jumping into something, having no idea how it's going to work, making bad choices.
Wayne has homework.
Yeah, I'm going to go back, and you guys have very valid points. Very. But I think your scope is skewed toward the okay, we're gonna jump out of the gate with a campaign.
All right,
I've got a group of guys that we're gonna start playing with. Never done this before. Maybe we've role played a little bit, but I've never GM'd, I've never run a campaign, but you're just going to start out of the gate. I think I look at the module as this is what you should do as your prequel. This is how you get things going for a GM, because it's baby step. Just like children learn to read with C-Spot Run type of book.
I think you can use a module.
But that's what I'm going for there. I'm not saying, well, I agree. The story, it's canned. It's not that there's no imagination to it.
Right. Yeah, you Pat know, and I were saying the same thing.
But you're learning the mechanics. You are learning the basics out of it. Mm. And then you go on from there.
To build on Pat's point, though, I don't think a lot of RPGs really go into and address that issue, saying, look, go ahead and start with the pre-made thing that we have in the back here. But once you're done with that, by all means, chuck it. Yeah. Get rid of it. Don't do it anymore past maybe two or three sessions past this adventure. And once you're done with that, then go back and make your own people and build your own stories. I don't think a lot of games do that.
To me, the pre-made adventure in the back of the book, it serves a useful purpose. The ones I've seen, I think Shadowrun had one. I think
Mouse Guard had one?
Yeah, I think Mouse Guard has one. And Mouse Guard's is pretty detailed, though. But the other ones that I've seen, it is to introduce you to the combat system. It's an adventure where it has basically no plot. Like the Shadowrun one, I think you're like robbing a Quickie Mart or something stupid like that. But you're
in a Quickie Mart while it gets robbed.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it's not about a story or character development. It is what it is. It is a situation that makes you roll a few skill checks, roll initiative, roll combat, take damage, deal damage, and do the aftermath of the combat. And that's fine. I mean, because it's not there, like you said, to be this big, long, huge
thing. I think a module can serve a purpose. And I agree with what Chad's saying, that I think a module may undercut a DM's or GM's first experience by doing the work for them that they should be focusing on. But I think it could also help in the same way that having someone sit down and give you some pointers on the rules may make the rules a little less intimidating. Having a book you can flip through to give you a possible plot idea or a few NPCs or some inspiration to pick from, particularly if you're new to this and you don't even know where to start, I would not recommend running a module for the reasons that Chad stated, but I think a module might serve as a handy little reference guide. Now, what I passed Wayne during that paper shuffling was a Battletech adventure, two D&D adventures, but then also something a little bit different. So Wayne, in the book there that I gave you in your right hand, open that up, and I want you to tell me who wrote that book.
Some old guy, Christopher Hussey?
Yeah.
Hack! So, hack!
Total
what you,
hack.
Are you looking at Royalty and Rogues?
Hotspots.
Hotspots.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
now,
man.
Let
that
me
was
tell
my
you,
first book, by the way.
All right, well,
was
let
it
me,
really?
Let me
it
tell
was,
you what,
it was.
Chris, nice. I used Hotspots. This was back even when Tex and I hated you.
But, he used it. It sucked.
But I used Hotspots for many campaigns. So let me, for anyone who's not...
Look at this big open white space and the watermarks on the page take it up so...
Let me explain.
That is not Hotspots he's looking at. I'm
no, that's the other. There's two parts to it. But let me explain the concept behind Hotspots.
Why don't you actually do some writing on this? Jeez.
Who's not familiar with that era of Battletech. What Hotspots was Chris put out a book that basically was just mission ideas. It was not fully developed adventures.
Triple space, 20-point font.
Well, the other book's more full. But the point is, it was not fully developed adventures. It was not box text and NPCs. It was just, here's an idea. You go to a planet and this kind of thing happens. Or you get a contract because this planet over here is having this kind of problem. And here's some pointers to help the GM get started. And it was just stuff to point you in the right direction, to give you ideas, but it did not handhold you or limit you in terms of your imagination. And Chris did a great job, and I used those books for several games.
I still hold to my original statement that I don't think modules are a good idea, because I think what you should do is if someone comes to you and says, hey, you're in this experienced role player, you're experienced GM, I'm new to this whole concept, but I want to do it. I want a GM. I have some friends. What you should do is not what Chris did. Not hand them books and not hand them a module and not say, here, go forth into the world and good luck. You're going to learn how I did, kid, just by failing. You should sit down with them. Just say, hey, when's a good time for you to come over, me to come over, and us to sit down and go through this? And I'm going to show you what I do. You're going to write this adventure. You're going to write this little story here. You're going to make the NPCs, but I'm going to sit down with you. I'm going to show you my technique. I'm going to show you how I do it. And you sit down with them and say, okay, first thing you do, what do you want to tell a story about? okay, what are some cool stuff that you want to have happen? What are some people that you can populate with it? And then you write down these ideas, and then you go through the process.
If you go in with this mentoring idea that you're putting out.
I know, crazy mentoring hippie idea here, working with people.
You could also role play, sit there and be like, okay, what's your story about? Well, this. Okay, what happens if they kill the Baron in the first scene?
Yeah.
And they'd be like, oh, man, I don't know.
Oh, my game collapses. Oh, no, but it doesn't collapse because this is what I do. Let me show you this secret.
What about the guys you're playing with? You know, I know one guy is kind of a spaz, and he's not going to care about the princess if you tell him that this is over here or something. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of walk them through some of the pitfalls they might fall into. Now, I realize this would not have helped Chris because he said at the start of this he was in a hurry. He had no time.
The setting was not conducive to doing it in a proper fashion. I certainly still think the situation is salvageable, but continue.
Here's Chris's thing. What do you do when you...
I know, it stretches all the way down there. How's that feeling for you, huh? Oh, I just got ran over by a semi. Okay, keep going.
It's going to be watching the road with us tomorrow.
it's got one eye.
Paint little eyes on it.
The worst part is...
another one, anyway.
The worst part is with the snow up there, this is shrinkage.
Yeah.
And it's deep, too.
So, anyway, that's horrifying. Moving on. So, you know, the situation where you don't have a lot of time, the kid comes up to you, ask you for help. I think you give him one or two little pieces of GMing advice, you know, like, don't let him scare you, and they don't know you hold all the cards, so if you mess up, they don't have to know it yet. And give him a couple of little, you know, acorns like that, but then you make the time. Say, when's a good time for you? If you're interested, we should sit down and talk about this. Because, you know what? The kid, if he does this right, he's going to spend a couple of hours to do this game that hopefully, if the hobby hits for him and it latches on for him and his friend, is going to make gamers out of several of his friends and gamers out of him that will hopefully last them a lifetime. You can't take a couple of hours out of your day to help out with this hobby that you love, that you've devoted a lifetime to? I mean, seriously, don't throw the kid a module. Sit down with him. Talk to him. Help him. This is how the hobby grows, people. It doesn't grow by publishing books and hoping people buy them. It grows by people who play the game, introducing the game to people who haven't played the game, and then helping them to play it and talking about how wonderful this hobby is.
And not being an ass at the same time.
That's right. Sorry, soapbox. I'm done. Soapbox.
No, but you know what, though? Yeah, I mean, yeah, okay, it's a soapbox. But quite honestly, I mean, say you actually, in a certain respect, you have changed my mind a little bit in this chat. Because I would agree that, in general, a module would be a good place to start using Pat's argument. But the way I perceived evangelizing the hobby, for me, always was from running events and getting people to play in those events who are new, and then check a thing, you know, and having a good time, and then leaving it at that, and then essentially leaving them to go and fend for themselves. But it really, what you're saying too, it comes down to, it needs to be more of a complete task. You need to, yes, go ahead and do it that way, but there needs to be follow-up. You need to check in with them. You need to go and say, how is it going? Who's running stuff? You know, how are you doing? What's your situation?
Have you heard of this great podcast called Fear the Boot? They might help.
Well, what do you think he had on top of that pile of books? Here's a huge pile of 100 pounds of books, and here's episode 115.
But that was the thing. It was funny you mentioned that, because I handed him this stuff, and then as we were talking, the time that we were talking there about it, you know, I thought to myself, there really should be some sort of generic GM primer pamphlet that you can, you know, like, so you want a GM, you know, and this little trifold.
We should make that our next 115, called the GM Toolbox or something, or the GM Primer.
I certainly do think that a lot of Game Master sections of books certainly do a good job of talking about, certainly defining the role and what you do as Game Master, but I think that there's some advice that they don't talk about. The fact that, yes, by all means, throw out the game if you feel it's not working. Get rid of what you're doing and start over if it's not working, if it feels clunky, or run a few sessions run a few sessions with what you've got, and then just leave it at that, and then start over, because you'll have gotten your feet wet, you'll have walked into the lake to the point where the cold water hits your nuts, and then it won't be a problem after that point.
Where are we going with this?
Then you can dive in.
What are we talking about now?
I'm giving an analogy.
I don't know what this will come out to after edits, but we're kind of around the hour mark here, so I guess we'll go and wrap this one up. We have a topic.
Man,
here.
I totally had this topic. I really wanted to talk about it.
I know. Chad's got a topic about role-playing, not the hobby, but the specific act of role-playing that he wanted to talk about, which I have noted here, which we'll come back to the next time we meet. Now, I gotta
update the Twitter feed. I twatted all over the internet.
I don't know what will be released next, because we have two possible things coming down the pipe. One is we still have a bonus episode we did when Mikey was in town we need to release. Mm-hmm. The other is, presuming things go well, the next week we will be recording the LARP roundtable, and we're going to see how that goes and use that as a decision point on whether we want to attempt other listener roundtables.
I hope so, because I'm looking forward to the European one.
But yeah, there's a lot riding on these handful of folks here that are involved in this. But don't know which we're going to release next. Have no idea how the holidays will pan out.
We're not held down to anything, man.
But in the meantime, you guys keep having great games, and we will catch you next time.
Have a good holidays. And you know what? It's good to be back, even if it's just for one episode. It feels good. I missed you guys.
Who are you again?
I have absolutely no idea.
You forgot.
I'm the guy with the huge in the wood-carved toys, apparently.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2009. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.